You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a look at inflation and the economy in this year's election campaign. First, sometimes it's anyone's guess what candidates for public office would actually do if elected. In the race for Wisconsin governor, voters have been given more than 120 examples of what they could expect. They're all bills that pass the Republican-dominated state legislature, only to be vetoed by Democratic Governor Tony Evers. As Sean Johnson reports, those bills and many more could become law if Republican challenger Tim Michaels wins in November.
Tony Evers vetoed a total of 126 bills in the last two-year session of the legislature. Since Wisconsin became a state in 1848, no governor has vetoed more bills in a single session. Included on this list were bill after bill that would have made changes to Wisconsin election laws, including by adding hurdles to voting absentee. These were top priorities for GOP lawmakers, and at a September campaign rally, Tim Michaels tells Republican voters they'll be priorities for him.
We are going to take those bills that Tony Evers vetoed. We're going to get them right. I'm going to sign them.
It wasn't just election bills that Evers rejected. He vetoed gun bills, including one that would have proclaimed that any federal bans on assault weapons don't apply in Wisconsin. He vetoed bills that would have chipped away at the safety net, like a plan to trim unemployment benefits down from 26 weeks to as little as 14. At the same rally, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss makes reference to all of them.
It's going to happen, and I promise you, when we are here in 1 year with Governor Michaels, every single thing that Governor Evers has vetoed is going to be considered by the legislature, and hopefully all of it becomes law because we are back to being the conservative, revolutionary place that Wisconsin was under Governor Walker.
This riles up Republicans. With one election, by winning this one race for governor, a full-speed-ahead conservative agenda could be theirs. But it also means Democrats see Evers as essential to blocking that agenda. Republican lobbyist Bill McCoshin worked for former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson. Even though the former governor had a record of working with both parties, McCoshin said Thompson would brag about the Democratic policies he stopped in order to motivate GOP voters.
It shows the strength of the office and why the office is important. So highlighting that, there's no downside to that, at least in my opinion, and Tommy proved that. You can be out there saying, listen, I stopped all these bad things that you, my base, are against. And that's why you need to fight hard to reelect me.
On the campaign trail, Evers is soft-spoken, low-key. During a recent campaign stop at the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, Evers asks student supporters, politely, to get out and vote.
And please vote for yours truly, a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I'm always going to be a Badger. Thank you.
His speech here talks about what he's for, including education funding and legalized marijuana. He doesn't talk about vetoes, but in this crowd, he doesn't have to. People say Evers' veto power is part of the reason they're supporting him. Grant Hall, a sophomore studying computer science and data science, worries about the election bills Republicans would sign without Evers.
And I feel like it'll prevent a large number of Wisconsin voters from being able to go out to the polls and have their voice heard.
Rihanna Mukherjee, a senior at the UW-Madison majoring in political science, says that without Evers, Republicans would have too much control.
I think in a democracy you need balancing voices, and our Republican legislator doesn't balance voices.
In an interview after his speech, Evers says his vetoes reflect his value system, and people know that.
Part of my job going forward, again, the next 4 years, will be to be that goalie and prevent bad legislation from becoming law.
And if he's not governor, Evers thinks those bills will be passed and signed as quickly as possible. In the contentious race for governor, it's one issue where Evers and Republicans seem to agree. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, we've been highlighting different election issues recently on Central Time. Last week, we looked at crime, for example. Another issue that's often top of mind for voters is the economy, and lately, inflation has been a big part of that story. The U.S. is among many Western countries facing long-term inflation, around 8% in the U.S., a bit higher than Canada, a bit lower than Mexico, the U.K., and the Eurozone. We've talked to economists about the factors driving inflation, including the pandemic, supply and demand, and supply chain disruptions, as well as the part played by government spending. Now we're going to get into the political side of inflation and the economy and how candidates and voters are talking about the issue. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How important is inflation and the wider economy for you as a voter? How does it motivate you on election day or when you cast your absentee ballot in advance of it? Who do you blame for high inflation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Maurice Shepard is professor of political science at Madison College. Maurice, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Rob.
Well, polling, Maurice, in Wisconsin and around the country shows a lot of interest, a lot of concern about inflation and the economy this time around. And traditionally, the economy is a big deal. How important do you see it being in this midterm election?
Well, inflation is a major issue in this election, as it is in every election. Just looking at sort of polls coming out of Wisconsin, and I think these would mirror what we see nationally, inflation is the number one issue. Here in Wisconsin, the Marquette poll then would list, and I think it's important to put inflation in context mm-hmm. with the other issues. Second would be crime, once again, gun violence. And then third would be reproductive rights, again, abortion bills, and then education, taxes, and then sort of falling sort of toward the end of the line would be immigration and climate control. But what I would also like to say about in terms of inflation and its relationship to politics is that it's important, I think, to look at this in terms of not all inflation is the same in terms of how we actually measure. And I am not an economist, but inflation is measured by looking at different economic categories. A big one would be that really hits people on a daily basis would be inflation related to food and energy. Those are essential items that everyone needs, and people see and feel that inflation on a daily basis. So while inflation sort of writ large is important in terms of politics, those particular items as they relate to inflation really have a sensitivity to, once again, politics.
I want to look at the governor's race here. Now, a governor doesn't have a lot of control over inflation, but at the only debate in the race for governor last week, both candidates were asked what they would do to help people deal with inflation. Democratic Governor Tony Evers answered first, mentioning that inflation is a global issue impacting people around the world. Here's some of his answer.
And I've been really hoping that the Republicans would come in session and we could do something about it right now. But my plan is this: to mitigate against inflation, we're going to lower our taxes on our middle class folks in the state of Wisconsin by 10%. We're going to get rid of the minimum markup law on gasoline, which could save people up to 30 cents on a gallon, and also some tax credit issues. But most importantly, the one that is most important is the one about child care credit. That way, we're giving people the money to keep the money, and we can mitigate against inflation.
And then here's Republican candidate Tim Michaels.
What are some of the problems? Joe Biden, weak on inflation, canceling the Keystone Pipeline. What can we do? We can put more money in people's pockets. I'm a businessman. I understand macroeconomics. I understand how to read a balance sheet. I'm going to do everything I can to put more money in people's pockets to help them with the price at the pump and the surging price of groceries. We're going to do massive tax reform, get more money in people's pockets here in Wisconsin, and the hardworking, taxpaying people of Wisconsin will spend more of that money on goods and services, helping make our economy here even more robust.
Now, both of them mentioning some tax cuts, putting more money in people's pockets, as Michaels put it, but that can increase demand, that can increase inflation. I don't know. Do governors really have a lot of policy tools in their toolkit, Maurice, to deal with something like inflation?
They have limited tools in their toolkit to actually sort of deal with that. But I think what really stands out in terms of, again, sort of the clip that you just played was in terms of the state income tax. I think Governor Evers mentioned he would, once again, provide some minimal, once again, sort of reduction. But for Tim Michaels, I think he's gone on the record by saying he would like to eliminate the Wisconsin state income tax altogether. And I think also during that debate later, he also addressed the rainy day fund that Governor Evers sort of touted that as a good thing in terms of that the rainy day fund for the state of Wisconsin is fully funded. And Tim Michaels responded by saying that just shows that government is taking in too much money. So I think in general for Governor Evers, he's looking at again, sort of an incremental way to see what the state can do to reduce inflation and the harmful impacts it will have on Wisconsinites. For the challenger, Tim Michaels, he's taking a much more bold approach to it by, again, proposing to eliminate the state income tax. And also what it sounds like is that he would also get rid of the rainy day fund.
On a national level, how are you seeing the two parties tackle or avoid, I guess, the issue of inflation?
On a national, it's in general, and history on this is not on the Democratic Party side. That in terms of inflation, the Democratic Party traditionally, and I'll just use once again, Democratic presidents, that when they were in office and inflation was high, it did not help them when it came time for re-election. So if we go back to just after World War I, Woodrow Wilson was hit with rising inflation. Warren Harding sort of won after that. Going back to the 1950s, President Truman had high inflation. Dwight Eisenhower came in and won. Same thing as we get to the 1980. Jimmy Carter did not just have inflation, he also had stagflation, which was something new at the time. And Ronald Reagan famously sort of pointed out his famous statement to the American voters, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And of course, Reagan won in a landslide. So nationally, if we use once again the national results and history, it does not look good for Democrats going into, once again, at least this midterm election.
We're talking about the economy and inflation as election issues. Maurice Shepherd is with us, professor of political science at Madison College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you rank inflation and the economy when it comes to casting your vote? Are they on your mind as you make a decision, or is there something else that gets out ahead of those issues? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you want to hear from candidates for governor, Senate, state legislature, you name it, when it comes to inflation? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Maurice Shepherd, professor of political science at Madison College, looking at the economy and inflation, how influential they could be as issues in the midterms. You can let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Tim is with us on the road near Madison. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. Go for it.
Good. I tend to be sort of a little bit right of center, but I vote for Republicans and I vote for Democrats. But I think I'm on a fixed income. I'm 72 years old. And it's no accident this inflation is happening, and it's hurting people like me. I did not care for Donald Trump as a president. Personally, I thought he was a scumbag, but he was an excellent president, in my opinion. And isn't it amazing how the day he leaves office, everything turns south as far as the economy is concerned? And I got to believe it's a plan. And it's a plan that has to be stopped, or this country's going into the ditch.
Tim, thanks for the call. I don't know about the plan part of the Maurice, but Democrats have to be worried that voters like Tim will associate inflation and blame it on Democrats.
Sure. And to follow up on what Tim is highlighting is that in terms of politics, one way to think about this is a lot of times we talk about abstract ideas, democracy, liberty, those sorts of concepts. But when we get to inflation, we're talking about something tangible that, as Tim pointed out, impacts, once again, people on a daily basis. And some of the data show that, particularly as you look at different voting groups, particularly for middle class and working class voters, it hits them really hard in terms of, once again, their quality of life and what they can do. And particularly in Tim's case, for those that are a bit older, again, maybe retired or about to retire, it hits them not just at the grocery store and at the pump, but also it will hit them in terms of medical care, medical services, and the prescriptions that they need. So for a voter like Tim, it's hitting him sort of double whammy. In terms of a conspiracy, I think what we probably are not appreciating in general, sort of, again, not any one group, but the historic nature of the pandemic, it really changed everything in a number of different ways. So if there is a conspiracy out there, I don't know exactly what it is, but I think we are still underappreciating the severity of the pandemic on our economy, on politics, and on society.
Thanks for the call, Tim. Deborah is with us now in Winona, Minnesota. Deborah, hi.
Hi. My issues are a little bit different than what your guest is talking about. For me, climate change is the big thing. And we don't even talk about the economic impact that has on people. The snow crabs in Alaska, completely destroying the crab fishery there. That's going to impact their economy a great deal. And then after the environment is women's reproductive rights and on preserving our democracy. Right now there are a lot of forces trying to change voting rights and gerrymander districts and things. And I think those are my three main issues. Inflation for me is an international issue. And
Deborah, I got you. We've got a lot of callers and I want to bring Maurice in on that. Thanks for calling in. Economy and inflation, big issues, Maurice. They are clearly not the only things on the table here.
Correct. And I think Deborah did a good job of highlighting the fact that there will always be a disconnect between when we talk about a particular policy, if it's inflation or climate change, and how that relates to politics. Politics tends to be short-term in nature. We go from one election cycle to the next and that sort, while these policy issues that we have to deal with, again, climate change being very important along with inflation, those require long-term solutions. So there's always some, resistance there for short-term thinking politicians to engage in long-term action.
Thanks for that call, Deborah. Ben joins us now in Sparta. Ben, hi.
Hi. I think that the attempts on the part of the Republicans to tie inflation to government spending under President Biden and the Democrats, the majority of the spending that has increased the deficit is spending that occurred because of COVID, programs to offset the problems of COVID. And the majority of that spending, which benefited a lot of people and went back to the taxpayers, that occurred under the Trump administration and the Republican and Democratic Congress.
Ben, thanks a lot for that call. It gets into some nuance, Maurice, but I have seen the case made like, yes, we have inflation. Yes, some of it is because of the spending Ben mentioned, but we have very good employment numbers, in part, people argue, because of that very spending. Are people balancing things in as nuanced a way as Ben is, do you think?
I think Ben is probably far ahead of the game in terms of, again, looking at a complex issue and sort of untangling it. I think the truth lies somewhere in the fact that for most Americans, and some of the polling, once again, will highlight this, that when you think of government, particularly big government, people think Democratic Party. So if there is a policy or something that is taking place in which government seems to either be the source of the problem or agitating the problem, then again, sort of the Democratic Party will get, again, the lion's share of the blame for that. For the Republicans, again, they've done a very good job of crafting a message that they are the party of business, of corporate America, and that they, quote unquote, solve problems. Now, if that's truly the case or not, that's not for me to say, but I think that's the general message that most Americans have. If government is bad, they link it to the Democratic Party.
Thanks for that call. Diane joins us now in Fitchburg. Diane, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to make a point that I believe a big problem with all of this overall plan is profiteering. The fact that we see gas shortages or gas prices going up or wheat shortages or with cars, you know, circuit shortages. And prices go up, but then they never seem to come back down. And I see this as part of the American success story that, you know, you make a big amount of money here, there, or wherever, and that's idolized.
Diane.
And it's at the expense of us.
Diane, thanks for the call. Marisa, just cutting off because we don't have a ton of time left. Some polling suggests that I think some 70-some percent of people say blame in part corporate profiteering for inflation. 60-some percent also blame the Biden administration. But who people blame may be a factor in their political decisions.
Right. And I think, Diane, again, sort of focused in on a key issue that what we're going through right now, part of this will be maybe temporary. I looked at some recent reporting and analysis that actually what we're experiencing right now in terms of inflation will subside within the next 6 months or so. But she also highlights the importance of, and I am not an economist, mm-hmm. but in the economic literature, they call it sort of rent seeking, again, getting these extra benefits, or as Diane put it, profiteering. And this is something that just simply needs to be worked out. I am not an economist, so I'm not going to sort of go down that
sure.
road, but I understand exactly what Diane is saying.
Diane, thanks a lot for that call. Maurice here in Wisconsin, there is a booming growth industry in campaign ads. Are you expecting to see a lot of attention, especially from the major statewide candidates, on the economy and inflation in the remaining few weeks?
Yes, for many of the races here in Wisconsin, almost all of the other than for the congressional race, I think the third congressional district, La Crosse, that's going to be competitive. Again, the gubernatorial race and also, again, the race for Senate, those will also be, once again, competitive. So, I think the advertising and promotion will just increase. The money will continue to flow in, and it will be very intense as we get closer to Election Day.
Maurice, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Maurice Shepard, professor of political science at Madison College. We talked to them about the politics of the economy and inflation and how much of a factor they could be in the midterm election campaigns. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, comedian and mystery science theater legend Joel Hodgson joins the show for a look at bad movies and what makes them great. I don't know if often have host envy. A little bit do. Would have been fun to talk to him, but we'll get to listen to Kate do it. That is in the not-too-distant future. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30. You could join in if you're a fan with your questions or your favorite bad movies. That's coming up tomorrow on the Ideas Network. I play the saxophone. That's not me playing there, but I'm always interested in checking out performances by other sax players. That version of the theme from Love Story was played by an Italian musician a few days ago. Nothing too special about that, but it's a weird venue. It's an operating room during brain surgery, and the sax player is the patient. As reported by CBS and others, Italian surgeons removed a brain tumor from that patient. And yes, apparently you stay awake during the surgery, though I guess you don't feel it so much. Surgeons didn't want to disrupt the musician part of the patient's brain, so they had him play saxophone on and off during the 9-hour procedure. The tumor successfully removed. The patient can still play the sax. Not the first time this has happened. NPR reported on another sax performance during brain surgery back in 2017. I've had some weird gigs over the years. Nothing that can top that. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the new documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust, looks at how the U.S. responded and, in some cases, failed to respond to the Holocaust. One of the filmmakers joins the show. Now imagine a world where you can walk down the sidewalk in your neighborhood and find fresh fruits, veggies, nuts growing right out of the ground for anyone to pick and eat for free. It's a future that a Wisconsin nonprofit group is trying to make a reality. They're called Wisconsin Food Forests. They already have a few projects running in La Crosse, Madison, and Milwaukee. You can also do it in your own front or backyard. Emily Steinway is one of the co-founders of Wisconsin Food Forests. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Can you paint us a picture of how a food forest works?
Well, ironically, the easiest way to plant one is to start with a flat mowed lawn. So once you have that, you can add in the edible, mostly native and mostly perennial plants of choice. So we usually go with fruit trees and shrubs. We'll plant things for pollinators as well. Herbs, ground covers like strawberry. And we'll also put in some shrubs. Occasionally we'll do some perennial vegetables, and they all kind of grow together. You plant the taller plants to the north and the shorter plants to the south so that everything gets plenty of sunlight. And it's basically trying to mimic a forest ecosystem because it's such a stable way of producing food.
And the concept here is you're not just growing it for yourself to eat or sell or something like this. The idea is it's in a public-ish space where what people can stop by and snack for free.
Yes. Yeah. We try to plant these food forests for free on public land or for other nonprofit organizations. So the main one that has been the most successful is called Lansing Food Forest, and it's on the east side of Madison. And the neighborhood, the Eastmoreland neighborhood, has really embraced it and helped with maintenance and let us use their water, which was critical for getting the food forest established. And now people, yeah, they come by and they pick strawberries with their kids, or they'll harvest tomatoes in the summer. And it's also become a neighborhood gathering space. So we'd like to plant food forests so that they're accessible for people.
What was the inspiration for this idea for you?
Well, for me, I've always enjoyed eating fruit. And so I started out as a hobby planting fruit trees for friends and family. And then I turned it into a business. And then when my friend Aaron and Rodney came up with the idea for Wisconsin Food Forests and asked me to join, I was super excited and started scheming and planning right away. And we planted our first food forest with our organization in 2019 at a farm sanctuary, so that the plants will be there for not only the people, but also for the farm animals.
Now, as you mentioned, this could be on private land or land owned by a nonprofit. You've also worked with city governments. Are there likely suspects out there, patches of land that don't have a lot of other good options for them? What kind of things are you looking for?
Yeah, so we're lucky here in Madison. We have the city of Madison has the edible landscape permit process, which is a page on their website and a whole series of steps that you can follow in order to plant on city-owned land. And that's how we got Lansing Food Forest. It's on city engineering land. We've been contacted by people from other cities around Wisconsin to help them figure out how they can work with their city. And it usually involves meeting with your city representative, your alder, or someone on the city council, and reaching out to the people in your community, talking to them, seeing who's interested. It only takes about 3 or 4 people to get the whole process going, and we're definitely able to help with that. We're hoping to do something in Fort Atkinson next year, and also in Sharon, Wisconsin, and Reedsburg, Wisconsin. We've been working with them as well.
And I understand, at least from your website, you were looking for more possible food forest sites in 2023. If people are out there hearing this thinking, yeah, that sounds cool, and I know just the spot, what do you want to hear from them? What can they do to get in touch with you?
Yeah, so our website is wisconsinfoodforests.com, or they can email us at contact@wisconsinfoodforests.com. We do have a couple things in the works for 2023, but nothing is set in stone yet. So we're still looking for a few more potential sites.
And it sounds like step one is clearly building your local team. Do you have suggestions on how to reach out to, I guess, neighbors in particular to say, hey, does this sound cool to you?
Yeah. Yeah. Find a site. If you can, something that's flat and mowed, because that's going to be the easiest to transform. And then find a water source is also critical. So either city water or a neighbor who's willing to let people use their water. And you only need to water for the first 1 or 2 or 3 years, because since we're mostly planting perennials, once they get established, your watering needs go way down, and they're also going to be generating their own mulch once the forest is more mature. So if you have those things and then just a few people, you can get a food forest going in your community.
Emily, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Emily Steinway, one of the co-founders of Wisconsin Food Forests. She was with us today for a look at their efforts to grow free fruit and vegetable and nut plants on public lands for anyone to eat. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Cuban refugee who lives in La Crosse. He's one of the people featured in a new podcast, WPR Reports, Uprooted.
When Ernesto Rodriguez of La Crosse was 24 years old, he left the only home he'd ever known, Cuba.
And then when they asked me, "Do you want to leave Cuba?" I go, "Yeah, because I don't want to be there."
He, along with 125,000 of his fellow Cubans, hopped on boats bound for the United States in 1980. They were part of the mass exodus known as the Mariel Boatlift, a rare moment when President Fidel Castro allowed residents to leave the island. Among that group that fled, almost 15,000 ended up at Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin, including Erne. And while living there, Erne spent a lot of time in the kitchen. The staff were cooking the refugees American food, like hamburgers and hot dogs, food they hadn't developed a taste for yet. So a cook named Tony asked Erne a question.
And Tony asked me, "What kind of food you guys like? It's Cuban food." I said, "What the Cuban food?" And then I show him like how they make a congri and a chicken fricassee and mashed potato, but not like mashed potato from here is different.
And it's in this kitchen that Erne met someone who was born and raised in Sparta, someone who had become family.
I'm just Brian Brandstetter. Ernie's my brother from another mother.
Mm-hmm.
My family was one of the sponsors of Erne back in 1980.
We are a good friend, we are a good brother, because I love the guy like he's my own brother.
Well, I've been your brother longer than not. Yeah, 41 years, 1980, wow.
In order for Erne to get out of Fort McCoy, he had to find a sponsor who would vouch for him and help him find housing and a job. That's where the Brandstetters come in. Brian's parents, Roger and Annette Brandstetter, became Erne's sponsors. Erne went to live with the family in Sparta.
Yeah, they moved into my bedroom and they wore our clothes that they could fit in. My parents would go shopping for them. You know, they fed them. They gave them love.
Yeah, mom, she was the best mom. I never had a mom.
Erne's new mom, Annette, is one of the most important people in his life.
I told Annette, my mom, every birthday, she making me an upside down pineapple cake. Every birthday.
Yeah.
Sometimes I say, "Mom, I don't want this no more." And she called me, "Benny, happy birthday. Come and get your cake." I said, "Wow, man, I'm lucky. Because they give me everything. I don't need nothing. They give me everything."
Roger got Erne a job at his car dealership. And this was a big deal, since it was not always easy for Cubans to find jobs.
And my dad had a very optimistic view. He goes, "Oh, we'll teach him English, we'll get him into church, we'll get him working."
But Brian says once they got to church, the new community wasn't necessarily welcoming of his new brother.
My parents lost a lot of their right-leaning friends because they're like, "How could you do this? You let them into your house. You let them work for you." And it's crazy. They didn't feel good about it. Our mom was a very stern woman, and she wasn't gonna take any crap from anybody. So she'd get all uppity, and she wouldn't care, and she'd create enemies.
Despite the pushback, Brian and Erne remained tight. They're family now.
Because nobody does that for a black guy in another country, and I always call you are my real mom.
Erne's journey to the United States wasn't easy. He's been through a lot, but he found sponsors who loved him and cared for him. Sponsors who would help him start a new life in Wisconsin. To learn more about Erne's life in Cuba how he served in the military, was sent to prison, and took a treacherous boat ride to get to the United States, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. All 8 episodes plus historical photos can be found at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we talk to one of the directors and producers of the new PBS documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust, which looks at how the U.S. responded and failed to respond to the Nazis' genocidal attacks on European Jews. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new documentary that Ken Burns says is the most important he's ever worked on examines the U.S. response to the Holocaust. The film, in 3 parts, looks at how racist immigration laws passed in the 1920s kept many Jewish refugees from escaping, how the country was far from a united front when it came to helping European Jews, and the tragic repercussions of public indifference and inaction. In an op-ed for the LA Times, the filmmakers wrote, quote, "Do Americans today have the courage to look at the mistakes of our past for the sake of our improvement?" Sarah Botstein is an award-winning documentary film producer. She's a co-director and co-producer of the PBS documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust, along with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. It'll re-air on PBS Wisconsin in January, and it's available online. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was a long time in the making. What was the inspiration to tackle the U.S. and its relationship to the Holocaust?
Well, Ken Burns, Lynn Novick, Jeff Ward, the incredible writer, and I all have different reasons for being extremely interested in this subject and films that we've made in the past, whether it was a series we did on the Second World War or a series that Jeff and Ken did on the Roosevelt Project. We've sort of, you know, been circling around aspects of what we explore in this film for many years. But in 2015, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. approached us as they were beginning research on a major exhibition that they launched subsequently in 2018 entitled Americans and the Holocaust. And they asked if we thought it was an interesting subject for a documentary and would we be interested. And we all said, absolutely, it's an extraordinarily important subject to try to understand this period in American history through a slightly different lens. And we said yes to making the film in 2015 and really got started a few years later.
And we usually learn about the Holocaust from the European perspective, Hitler's rise to power, the experience of Jews and other groups targeted by Nazis. What did we learn? What did you learn as you started shifting that perspective to what was going on here in the United States?
Well, thank you for that question. You know, I think we teach in America some of the themes that we explore in the film and some of the aspects that I think are the farther away we get from it, more important about the Second World War generally, kind of in separate silos and lanes. And so, if you're exploring the subject of the U.S. response to the Holocaust, you need to do 2 things. One, you need to actually understand the chronology of the Holocaust, and that is a European story in some way, right? But you also have to understand what Americans knew, when we knew the information, and how we responded to it. So you can shift away from the crisis in Europe to, I think, what we're experiencing now in our current politics of how do we respond as a citizenry and as a government to crises around the world.
A key part of the timeline was a new series of immigration policies in the United States in the 1920s that were then in place, of course, in the 1930s. 1933, Hitler comes to power. Can you talk about those immigration policies and then how they affected Jewish refugees trying to make it here to the United States?
Yes, absolutely. Centrally important part of the story and, you know, primary focus of the first of the 3 episodes that we put together. You know, until the 1920s, America was largely a country of open borders. It was very easy to get here. We did not have official immigration restrictive policies. We had the Chinese Exclusion Act, obviously, but things really began to change in the early part of the 20th century. And in 1921 and then in 1924, we had our first complicated and deeply restrictive immigration laws and quotas, and then actually didn't have an official refugee policy on top of that. So the time when, looking back at this history, we could have done the most in an interesting way is actually before 1939, as Hitler, as you just said, came to power, and then the crisis of the Jews in Europe, rose. Americans could have bended policy much more easily than once we were actually involved in the war.
And through the 30s, then, there was, you detail in the series, a debate, a lively debate. Some people passionately arguing that we needed to loosen up those laws to let more Jewish refugees in. Others, I guess, keeping the status quo of what those rules were at the time. Can you talk about that period of debate?
Right. So I think it's important to understand the debate, to understand actually the deep and complicated history of American anti-Semitism, actually, and how prevalent and mainstream anti-Semitism was even in our own State Department and government. So, those debates, I think, mirror the sentiments of the country. And one of the things I think is lost the farther away we get is how what the history of American anti-Semitism is and how it relates to a kind of racist, nativist, isolationist sentiment here.
Can you talk? I mean, it comes out as incredibly blatant, I think, by our standard, hopefully our standards today. What kind of things were people, even at the highest levels of government, saying faced with this reality of Jewish refugees seeking to come into the country?
Well, obviously, there's lots of offensive and racist and anti-Semitic language and cartoons and expressions. But I think the polling is also an important piece of to answer your question, that Americans were polled consistently during this time about what to do. And while Americans might have expressed sorrow and horror at some of the things they were hearing, that did not move the needle in terms of public debate or a change in attitudes toward Jewish people coming here and other refugees seeking asylum.
Can you talk about the human impact this ended up having, the anti-Semitic driven immigration policies? What was the human cost?
So, we let in over 200,000 refugees, more than any other sovereign nation took in during this time, and two-thirds of the Jews of Europe were wiped out. So I think that's a question deeply complicated to answer, but, I think the world failed the Jews in Europe. We failed the Jews of Europe. This is a great humanitarian crisis in human history, and we still have things to learn from it.
And I wanted to get into that in our last couple of minutes. There are debates about how we teach all parts of American history, I think, in our schools today. How much do we celebrate American history? How much do we look into the mistakes, the crimes, the bad things that have happened? Can you talk about the value of looking back, taking a tough look at moments like this in our history and trying to learn from them today?
Thank you for that question. I think that's the central thing that we're facing as a country. For me personally, I think you can celebrate the great privilege that it is to live in a mostly working democracy and how sacred our right to vote is, how important it is to have a government that reflects and is, a democrat, principally democratic. Having said that, I think the film shows how quickly civilized institutions and democracies can fail. And so teaching American history is central to that question. I don't think it makes sense to teach. You have to understand a deeply complicated past and celebrate what is good about our country, as well as we say in the film, some of the dark marks, so that you can do better in the future. Those things are not in conflict to me. Those things are actually in concert with one another.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sarah Botstein, award-winning documentary film producer. She talked to us about her new documentary. She's a co-producer and co-director, The U.S. and the Holocaust. You can go to the PBS Wisconsin website to find out how to view that, either through the website or an encore presentation of it coming up, I believe, in January. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there are some signs that the opioid epidemic may be slowing down, especially among younger people. A guest makes the case that we need to learn lessons now to help prevent the next widespread addiction problem before it starts. And get ready for Halloween with a look at some great horror movies. A Wisconsin film expert is going to join the show to share recommendations. I understand she's a big fan, and we're hoping you'll tell us some of your favorites or the ones that were maybe too scary for you. Let us know right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Do you have a go-to Halloween movie ritual that you watch every year around this time? Let us know your favorites. Again, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Halloween movies and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.